men and women in harm's way, send them into combat, create a dangerous gap in the information the Congress and the American people desperately needed. This cannot happen again.
Senator Rockefeller, yes.
You're listening to live coverage of the release of the report of the Senate Intelligence Committee on pre-war intelligence on Iraq from NPR News. We're now in the question and answer period when both senators will be taking questions from reporters in the Senate press gallery.
Well, first of all, I want to make a point, a very strong point, which I've made in the committee quite a lot. This is a community and a town and a group of all of us, which when there is a difference of opinion, we immediately say politics. And when you have a presidential election coming up, you say politics twice as quickly. You just make the assumption that legislators can't think, that nobody has, you know, independent views. Everybody is just guided by the fact that they're the Republicans or Democrats. I don't buy that. I think that there are honest policy differences. And in intelligence, which is such a discrete world, honest policy differences are real. They're real from time to time between Pat and myself. And it doesn't have to mean that it's a matter of politics. I can say that I wish we'd gotten more cooperation from the administration, and I think Pat Roberts would say that too, but it's not political. It's a matter of policy, the difference of policy. So the fact that the NIE changed so dramatically from its classified to its unclassified form and broke all in one direction towards a much more dangerous scenario, which is, what of course, what the American people got, I think was highly significant.
Senator Rockefeller,
may want to.
The CIA concludes that the report was approved unanimously.
Could we just sort of get it under control here? We have you listed on page 476 of the report. Go ahead. Please go ahead, and then we'll come back to you, sir, and then you, sir.
The unanimous report states no political pressure.
Yes, sir.
And you are now saying there was political pressure. So why did you vote for the report?
That's me. because there are 511 pages in the report, and the vast amount
Vice Chairman Rockefeller was asked, if you think there was political pressure, then why did you vote for this report?
Basically on weapons of mass destruction, was superb. And we had major disagreements on pressure. And I felt that the definition of pressure was very narrowly drawn in the final report. And that is that if somebody came up to you and you were one of the analysts who'd been working on WMD, and they said, did anybody tell you that you had to change your point of view? And the answer was no. Well, that was the description of pressure. That's not my description of pressure. That's a description of pressure. But another description of pressure is the total ambiance of this cascade of ominous statements. Yeah. Which continued really up to the present about what was going to happen, or the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, Muhammad Atta and the rest of it. So to me, pressure also can be defined by what else is in our additional views. And that is that George Tenet indicated that he was approached by analysts from the CIA, going to the director's office. If you've ever done that, that's sort of intimidating. And they came to him, and he said, to relieve the pressure, simply don't answer the question if there is no new information. But the key phrase there is to relieve the pressure. He was agreeing, assenting to the fact that there was. The ombudsman of the Central Intelligence Agency, whose job it is for people to come to with their complaints, a veteran of many years there, said that the hammering on analysts was greater than he had seen in his 32 years of service to the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was referring to pressure. And the former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Robert Kerr, had a group which did analysis of this within the CIA, and he also came up with the same conclusion, that the pressure was there, so it was internal to the analysts, and it was external in the whole ambiance, the whole sense of what the nation was moving towards, what the policymakers were, in fact, moving towards, except that we couldn't discuss that in our report.
Well, let me respond to that. I hope to heck there was pressure by the policymakers. You have to be forward-leaning. We just went through 9/11. We were very forward-leaning. There had been a long history in regards to Iraq and the war against Iran and the war, obviously, against Kuwait in the 91 when we found out they were much further ahead in regards to their nuclear program. You know, you can define pressure any way you want, but I think the debate in the committee largely centered around whether or not there were repetitive questions. And that's the job of a policymaker, to ask the repetitive questions. As a matter of fact, when they asked the repetitive questions, we got a better product in regards to the section in regards to terrorism. They were pretty reasonable about that. There were repetitive questions. There were not repetitive questions in regards to the WMD section. And as a result, we got a product that was flawed. I must say that in regards to all of the talk about the public statements by those in the administration, i.e. the policymakers, making very declarative and positive comments, even aggressive comments, I know about that. Everybody read about that. But those of us in the Congress, some of which who are the most severe critics, made the same comments back in 98, 99, 2000. I urge them to read their own comments in regards to the severity and the possibility of the fact that Iraq had WMD and that we had to use the military action. So I think it cuts both ways. Read the report. I do not think there is any evidence of undue pressure on any analyst. Repeatedly, I ask as chairman in public and in the committee if anybody felt pressured, more especially in terms of politics, let me know. Only one individual ever raised his hand, and it was about Cuba. And it was a completely different kind of thing. So if you think that repetitive question by policymakers and those of us in the Congress, I must say that some of the people who are complaining about pressure who serve on our committee and the Armed Services Committee and every committee, you've seen us ask witness, ask all sorts of witnesses various questions. Sometimes we don't even give them an opportunity to respond. Most of them, you know, perform very well. That's the job of a policymaker. And most analysts, all analysts know that. So from my standpoint, I do not think there was any political pressure. Now, was the WMD section wrong? You bet. And I think that that's the bottom line. Read the report, I think we and then we have an honest, you know, difference of opinion. But let me say again, there are those of us in the Congress who made very declarative and aggressive statements based on this same NIE report. Now, were we pressured? I don't know. You know, I believed it. You know, I believe it in regards to the mobile labs. I believed it in regards to the UAVs. I believed it in regards to the aluminum tubes, all of that. It proved out wrong. And so part of this effort is it took us a year to get beyond these facts, to dig into the assessments, and you see the size of the report. So it took us a whole year of oversight to get to the bottom of this in regards to whether or not it was accurate. I promise somebody right over here. Yeah, right here.
You concurred in the CIA's assessment that there was no evidence proving Iraqi complicity or assistance in an al-Qaeda attack, no evidence since then, no information emerging that Saddam tried to employ al-Qaeda in conducting terrorist attacks. And you said that this view was circulated among the highest levels of the administration. In light of statements like the president saying that al-Qaeda is an ally of Saddam, do you think that the administration misled in both public or private statements to you the association between...
Now, I think what they were trying to find out is three things. Number one, was al-Qaeda providing... Saddam Hussein providing safe haven for, you know, for the al-Qaeda? Secondly, were there efforts to train or to become involved or to have contact with al-Qaeda? Then the last one, of course, was there any operational plans And then one other that we were very interested in, and that is if we went to war or if we conducted any military operation, would any message be sent to al-Qaeda to start a war in other parts of the world? The terrorism section, I think, is very reasonable. Obviously, you're reading, you know, Senator Levin's, press release there.
No, I'm reading.
Okay, fine. Oh, one of the ones that's not redacted. That's good. All right. Okay, yeah. Yeah. I don't think they were missiles, no. And it's very reasonable. It gives some caveats. And I think school is still out in regards to, there's no question that Mr. Zakharoui was in Baghdad. Now, was there any operational assistance? Was there any training specifically? We don't know. So I don't agree with that statement. Yes, sir. And then over to Dana.
Given that 800 American GIs have lost their lives so far, thousands have had serious injuries, lost limbs, all on the basis of false claims, as much as the American taxpayers have had to kick in almost $200 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't the American public and the relatives of people lost their lives have a right to know before the next election whether this administration handled intelligence matters adequately and made statements that were justified before the election, not after the election?
Well, as Senator Rockefeller has alluded to, this is in phase two of our efforts. We simply couldn't get that done with the work product that we put out. And he has pointed out that that has a top priority. It is one of my top priorities. It's his top priority, along with the reform effort. Now, we have 20 legislative days. We want to have hearings from wise men and women in regards to the reform effort, and we will proceed with staff on phase two of the report. It involves probably three things, or at least three. One is the pre-war intelligence on Iraq, which is what you're talking about. Secondly, is the situation with the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Douglas Feith, and his activity in regards to material that he provided with a so-called intelligence planning cell to the Department of Defense and to the CIA. And then the last one, what is the last one? What's the third one? You know, help me with it. Well, that's the pre-war intelligence on Iraq, and there is a third one, and I don't know why I can't come up with it right now. But anyway, it is a priority, and I have told Jay, I have told everybody on the other side of the aisle, everybody on our side of the aisle, we will proceed with phase two. It is a priority. I made my commitment, and it will be done. Dana, and then we'll go over here.
I have one comment I need to make, and that is that if we're serious about doing intelligence reform,
Senator Rockefeller,
why do we have to be somehow limited by the fact that the leadership in the Senate and the House is saying that we're out of here after 20 legislative days? We could work through August. We can work through September. We can come back after the election. We routinely did that in previous years. Often working up until December 22nd. This is the most dangerous moment in American history. This is the most devastating event in American history was 9/11. And the thought that somehow we can't get this done before the end of the year simply escapes me as an adequate rationale to honor the families of those who died and to protect the families and people who are still living, but may be in a lot more danger.
I just say that the focus was on the NIE report of 2002. That's what that report's about. We will continue with our work with phase two. I've made that commitment. I don't know if we can get members back over the various breaks. When I mentioned the 20 legislative days, it was more to the approach that would we consider specific reforms. I think we have to have hearings first to educate the committee and really be very careful with that. But we are committed to finishing phase two. I promise, Dana.
There have been a number of references to the NIE. That's the National Intelligence Estimate.
Use of force in Iraq. And secondly, do you have confidence that John McLaughlin can lead the CIA?
We'll take the last one first. Both Jay and I and the members of the committee have worked with the assistant director at length. He's very well qualified, but I think that there is a feeling in the administration and shared by some of us that feel at this very crucial crossroads time that it would be appropriate for the administration to go through the work necessary to find an extraordinary candidate that could receive support from both sides of the aisle so that we would have a director. That is up to the administration, and I think I had thought, as a matter of fact, that they would make their minds up by the end of this week, although I think that's still being considered. But John McLaughlin is a good man, and he's very well versed, and acting in his role as the acting director has been helpful to the degree that we've been able to press back on the redaction efforts, and we've made some progress, and we'll continue to work with him.
Senator Roberts is talking about John McLaughlin, who is the assistant director for Central Intelligence and is now acting as director of Central Intelligence.
For Bosnia, President Clinton indicated we should have certainly intervened in regard to Rwanda. You can make the same case if you go back several decades to Cambodia. You can make the same case in World War II in regards to the Holocaust. I stood on a hill in a place called Hilla in Iraq, where there was a grave site that contained 18,000 bodies that were being unearthed one by one. And it was a very tragic moment. It made me think about man's inhumanity to man. The families of these victims were standing aside, and their grief was very evident by their wailing and all of that involves such a tragedy. Well, you multiply that up to about 500,000, and then you look back and you say to, I don't know how many more resolutions the UN would have to pass in regards to a humanitarian intervention, or whether or not that kind of military intervention that we conducted would have been conducted. But yes, I think the world is a safer place without Saddam Hussein. All of the current government, Prime Minister Alawi has said time and time again, thank you to the convention or to the coalition forces for removing Saddam Hussein. So I think it would have been argued differently. I think perhaps that the battle plan would be different. I think it would have been on a comparison to say Bosnia and Kosovo. But yes, I think I would have voted that way.
Senator Roberts.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
I find it interesting that we have neither
Senator Rockefeller
nor myself, except through the use of the word Al-Qaeda, have said anything about the war on terrorism for approximately 1 hour here. And that was always and remains, was, is, and will be our threat. Yes, I think it's terrific that Saddam was taken down, brought out of a hole. Has it changed things in Iraq for the better? I'm not sure it's made any difference. I'm not sure the jury is in on that, but I don't so far see any huge difference. The war on terrorism is in 100 countries, including our own, organized, ready, with potentially Osama bin Laden being sort of more back in control than he has been before, as well as Zawahiri and others. So this is the massive picture. When we argue about whether we should have not or not have gone into Iraq, the real question is, what about the resources? The question you asked, sir, the resources, the staying power of the American people on something which threatens us all for generations to come because of the hatred we have brought forth in the Islamic community towards America. Look, it's called the war on terrorism, and that is expensive, and that is big, and that's going to last a long time.
Senator Roberts, one more, and then we have to leave. George Tenet's role here in a couple of ways. Number one, how responsible was he specifically for all of the management errors and poor management?
I just urge you to read the report. I think it's very important that we quit looking in the rearview mirror and affixing blame and, you know, pointing fingers. The former DCI, made a statement yesterday, made a statement much earlier than that, accepting the responsibility. That isn't what this report is about, but it is about trying to inculcate better management practices up and down the entire intelligence, say, community. And that's what we're going to try to do in working with the intelligence community in behalf of reform.
Just to follow up to Dana's question, do you think if the vote was held today in Congress on the war, it would pass?
I don't know. How's that?
Can I respond?
Yes.
I don't think it would have. And I think I was in the Democratic leadership at that point, and I sat 50 feet or 40 feet directly looking at the president when he gave his second State of the Union address. And it was absolutely powerful, the axis of evil, all of these declarative and absolutist statements about 45-minute weaponization takeoff possibilities and WMD and unmanned air vehicles, et cetera, and their capacity to do damage. All of these things were brought forward in such a powerful and potent way. And I don't think that he was really speaking to the Congress. I think he was speaking to the American people about WMD, as it turned out. And it was a convincing case. It just happened to be a wrong case. What I found absolutely extraordinary was that in an interview with, I guess it was, Diane Sawyer, sometime later, he said, well, no, I guess we didn't, but so what? They could have. They would have. The fact is, they hadn't. I don't think Congress would have voted to support the war.
Well, let me just say this. I think that the President of the United States, and I'm not speaking
Senator
for
Pat
him,
Roberts.
Speak for himself, obviously, but he more than anyone knows the value of intelligence, and he more than anyone is going to have very strong support for reform within the intelligence community. He made very declarative statements. There's no question about it. He made a case to go to war. We all did. Look at the statements that we've all made, some of the people who are now being so terribly critical. We believed it. But the information was wrong. What he said was what he got from the intelligence community, and what he got was wrong. So he, more than anybody, I think, will want to work with us and the House side and the intelligence community to reform the intelligence. I think that's probably all the time I have time for. But anyway, thank you all for coming.
We're going to have it available for you.
The two senators have been holding up in front of the members of the press to whom they're talking a report which is about the size of a New York City telephone book. It's hundreds of pages with a lot of what they call redacted information, that is to say information which has been blacked out. There is an executive summary. As soon as we have seen that executive summary, we'll be reporting about it on all of our various news programs. Just this minute, Ron Elving, Vicki O'Hara, and this extraordinary, just give us your very brief thoughts.
Devastating, as Senator Rockefeller said. Could not have been more dismissive of the intelligence that led us to go to war.
And Vicki?
This was quite an indictment. Both Senator Roberts, the Republican, and the Democrat, Jay Rockefeller, just went through a long, long list of intelligence failures. And Senator Rockefeller said that these failures are likely to affect U.S. national security for years and years to come.
You've been listening to a press conference given by Senators Pat Roberts and Jay Rockefeller. They are the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Today, the committee's report on pre-war intelligence on Iraq was released. Thanks to NPR's Vicki O'Hara and Ron Elving for joining me here in the studio. Our engineer is Marty Curcius. The producer is Charlie Mayer. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you have been listening to a special report from NPR News.
And this is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. My name is Jack Brighton, hosting Focus 580 today. You've been listening to live coverage, obviously, from Washington of the U.S. Senate Committee on Intelligence. We will have that, by the way, archived on our website coming up. So if you missed all of it, you'd like to hear portions of it, you can look at our website, will.uiuc.edu, and listen to the archive later on today. We'll have that up. This is Focus 580, what remains of the first hour of the show. Let me just tell you what's coming up. We will, during the remainder of this hour, be speaking with Bill Rose, research architect with the University of Illinois Building Research Council, about architecture. This is your chance to call in and talk with the architect, something we like to do every once in a while. And we'll get started with Bill Rose in just a minute. I want to also mention that at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking with author Joel Achenbach about his latest book, The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West, a story about George Washington's grand scheme to use the Potomac as a bridge to the West to unify the nation. We'll talk about that at 11 o'clock. Well, let's get started here with Bill Rose. He joins us, as I mentioned, every once in a while. He is a research architect with the University of Illinois Building Research Council, and we'll talk about a variety of issues that pertain to architecture and buildings and our relationships to the built environment. We welcome your thoughts and questions and ideas. This is sort of a talk to the architect kind of segment. We'll talk about some of the current issues in the field, but also welcome your thoughts. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you are listening anywhere outside of Champaign-Urbana, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And Bill Rose, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being patient with our sort of interrupted hour here.
No problem at all.
One of the things that, we were talking while the news conference was going on about a number of things, but one of the issues that I find really interesting is how buildings represent our ideas of who we are, and we sort of, you know, invest them with all kinds of meaning and symbols, and then they become as... They substitute for those symbols in many ways, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes that can be kind of dysfunctional. But you know, to use one example, obviously over the past week we've had news of the, you know, the cornerstone laid of the Freedom Tower in New York, yeah, on the side of the World Trade Center. Obviously, this is something that has a lot of meaning for a lot of different people, and maybe right, probably different meanings for a lot of different people. It's going to be the largest. Tallest building in the world, as if to say, you want to knock our building down? Oh, yeah. Well, guess what? You know, we're back taller than ever.
Yeah. The German poet Goethe once said that architecture is frozen music. And there's a Chicago architect, his name escapes me at the moment, who said, architecture is frozen politics. I think it's true. That is, our symbols and our identity, our social, cultural, political, religious identity go together, for better or for worse. It would only be in sort of a monolithic, unicultural society that symbols could arise within that society outside of conflict. If there's one group in power, its construction of symbols is an effort to assert its power, to retain its power, to institutionalize it, to make it hang on for longer. The World Trade Center is, to me, an unsettled event, or an unsettled set of circumstances. I'm not entirely comfortable saying that we as a community or New York as a city is ready to institutionalize its memory of what will and will not be retained of those events by the symbolism of the tower. There are those who say, let's keep it, let's make it a quiet place for reflection. It's hard to do that, of course, in the middle of a city, but right, but it's that goes very nicely with what I think is the masterpiece of 20th century symbolic architecture, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which took the glorification of warfare and sort of turned it upside down, created a hole in the ground, a black wall that... with names on it that sort of said the earth opened up, took these 58,000 persons, closed back up again, please come by, visit, look at the reflections. You will see yourself. You will see the city. You will see the people behind you. You will see the names. You'll see 6 feet deep into the soil in which these bodies reside. I think that Maya Lin did such an outstanding thing in the creation of that symbol that that it has us thinking of the many different ways in which symbols can be shown within the landscape.
And that is an absolutely incredible thing to experience. I mean, this is a place that, like you say, it's in the middle of Washington, D.C. Well, it's you know, near the mall. And it is remarkable that it has this quiet about it,
yeah,
that impacts very deeply those who visit it.
And I hear it's either the first or second most visited site in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. The first may be the Air and Space Museum, and you don't go there for quiet.
No, indeed, indeed. Well, you know, and then as you mentioned prior to the start of the program, there was controversy about this notion of a monument, that this was not the traditional expression of such a thing.
Right. It seems when we talk about symbols, especially architectural symbols, we tend toward saying let's make a steeple, let's make a spire, a minaret, a skyscraper,
a statue.
Mm-hmm. Let's go tall. Let's go really big. I think I've mentioned this on the program before, but Walt Disney, when he was putting together Disneyland, complained to the architects that that Cinderella's castle really needed a weenie, he said. It really needs some symbol to stand up in the middle of the landscape to create a sort of a magnetic silhouette to draw people toward it. And so it's very natural, especially with the downfall of the World Trade Center, that people would say, let's reach for the stars. Let's go up as high as we can with this. It's written in our genes, perhaps. Mm. But I appreciate the way these events sponsor this kind of a discussion about what it should be and what it says about mm-hmm. us. Once it is put in place, once we see it, there will be the letdown that we seem to get every time a building's finished. It's always so much better before it's finished, while we're dreaming about it. Anyone who's built a new home and walks around in the studs and imagines where the kitchen and the bedroom are going to be feels that. And then and when the building is actually built, there's an emotional down, sort of a postpartum depression that occurs. I even have one builder who recognizes this, and when he's building a custom house for someone, he has one of his workers simply stay around and piddle around and sort of do things for the owner. Nothing really big, nothing really necessary, but it's sort of like just having the nurse come in after the birth of a child and just sort of show up and be there, because it's a joy and exhilaration. Those really aren't the feelings that we have. We really say to ourselves as a society, well, here's something we got to live with for the lifetime of the building.
Well, the ideal is one thing, but the reality is something less.
And architecture always plays between the practical and the ideal, the sacred and the profane. There's an undercurrent within all of architecture that among architects who should know better, there's a sense that they're priests, they're leaders in a spiritual activity. I hear a lot of people who come to lecture about architecture, they seem to waft toward the sacred, toward the spiritual. I had a research assistant who was a devout fundamentalist Christian. I'm not, and so we rarely talked about religious matters. But following this one presentation on campus, in which there was a description of spiritual, the sacred, the reaching for the infinite, I pointed out to him my displeasure with that sort of talk. And he expressed to me his displeasure. That's not where the sacred is for him. It's elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Louis Kahn was an architect who drifted this way. He liked to talk about the sacred in architecture. He picked up a brick and he would say to his students, "What does this brick want to be?" I pick up a brick with my students and ask, you know, "What does this brick want to do?" Crack, spall, fall, discolor, effloresce. Architecture resides in those two domains.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is someone in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, I have two questions. And again, it's not directed actually maybe against architecture.
Oh, that's okay. That's
but,
okay.
when is, you know, we've gone to this, I feel, extreme of larger and larger homes, you know, this massive thing. And I remember back at a time they were talking about more efficiency, you know, smaller homes, that kind of thing. But do you think we're ever going to counter this trend or not? we're up to 3,000 square feet.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You said you had two questions. Okay. Is that both of them or one of them?
No. Let's see. The other one is that in terms of innovation, it seems to me in many ways that we're sort of building the same kind of home as we did, I don't know how many past years, you know. What happened to the innovation in housing and the building of homes?
Boy, those are some excellent questions. Let's see what we can do with those questions. First of all, you're absolutely right about homes in the U.S. getting bigger and bigger. Last week, I completed a proposal for a substantial amount of money that puts AIA, the National Association of Architects, together with ASHRAE, the National Association of those responsible for heating, refrigeration, air conditioning, ventilation in buildings. These two groups don't always see eye to eye. But the purpose of this shotgun marriage, if you will, is to try to show that we can save 50% of the energy in our buildings. They're terribly inefficient. If you ask the engineers how come buildings are so inefficient, they'll blame it on the architects. And if you ask the architects why are they so inefficient, they'll tell you that the mechanical engineers just have all these standards, so they require all this control, so they require all this space and all this equipment. They blame it on one another. Okay, it's a log jam. We got to break it, and that's what we're going to try to do here. We're going to try to save 50% of the energy in residential and light commercial construction. Is this really possible? I think it is if architects assume their cultural role and they begin to say not that whatever the client wants is okay with me, but instead they say something that they always tell themselves that they're saying, that we make decisions over and above the peculiar individual interests of the clients. And here's a perfect case for them to show if they can really do that. We have to change elements in how people use buildings. And for starters, the buildings are just too damned big. I compared energy consumption in these sectors in the United States and France, and come to find out there's 43% that a French person consumes 43% of what an American consumes. We might say, okay, that there's a difference in climate, and then that brings us up to 50%. So can we save 50% of our energy? Yeah, move to France, and you got it licked. Okay, there's an automatic 50%. How is that achieved? Okay, a little bit with climate, but much more. They have smaller places. They are not nearly so wasteful. Of course, saying that we can make such an argument within society as it is.
Well,
it's quite a stretch.
Well, look at our cars, you know. I mean, yeah. SUVs are getting bigger and bigger, even as gas prices go up.
Right.
So that's kind of a strange contradiction.
If we might wind up framing this discussion to say it's hopeless, it's all over, we have 40 years of oil resources, useful oil resources left, and then it's lights out, and you people are incapable of reconfiguring society in order to dedicate the resources toward better later environments. If people are saying, I'm entitled to it, I'm going to have as big a house as I can afford, and nobody's going to stop me. If architecture cannot teach by example, and perhaps it can't, and if regulation also doesn't work, our goose is cooked. That's it. It's over. Nobody wants to hear the bad news, so they'll blank out that the way they've blanked out all of the other Cassandras about the upcoming fuel crises. So you're right that our houses are getting bigger, and that's just one very apparent symptom of a tendency within our society, not within all societies, but within ours, for profligate use of finite resources, and I'm quite pessimistic here.
The other issue is that, when you talk about resources, the additional resources in terms of lumber, and, it goes on and on.
Yes.
And
right.
It really drives up the prices of homes, and where does the people that are not in this lower middle class, et cetera, where, it's driving up their material costs, too. So
right.
it really is not. But anyway, thank you. Excellent
sure.
discussion.
Interesting point.
Thank you.
I think the last point of the caller was an interesting one because, those people who can't afford the 3,000 square foot houses, 4,000 or 5,000 in some cases, those houses are using resources that definitely affect the supply of the smaller houses as well.
Right. Absolutely. And not only that, if you have a big house, it fits on a big lot. You have a big lot, you can't walk from one place to another. It's too long a distance to walk. And so the size of the house impacts transportation as well. It's crazy.
We have another caller and maybe just about less than 10 minutes left with Bill Rose, research architect with the University of Illinois Building Research Council. We're talking about a variety of issues that pertain to architecture and buildings, and probably time for other calls if you'd like to join us. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And next caller in Terre Haute, Indiana, I believe, line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to know, I've always had this question. I live in an older home, and I've also lived in, I guess, what some people would call urban. I'd never thought of it that way because I live in Terre Haute, where they have a lot of lower-income houses and a lot of children.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about, or how could we go about as a society revamping those areas that have fallen by the wayside so that they are more efficient and so that families can afford them better?
Oh, that's an excellent question.
I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Those homes, even small homes, maybe even in dilapidated areas of cities, contain incredibly precious resources. They contain first growth lumber. You don't get any more first growth lumber. That's it. And those are being dumpstered, a lot of those homes. And in their place, we're building other homes, and we're using products that have ticking time bombs in them. the materials that we have. Let's just take one example, oriented strand board. If you go to a lumber yard and you look at a wood, you look for a wood panel product that you can use to create the sheathing of the walls or the roof, typically you'll get oriented strand board. It's not quite like real wood. You take a piece of real wood, it can get wet, it can get dry. I had people ask me to distinguish the difference between a piece of wood that was taken from a stave church in Norway built in 1100 and one that was just cut down 50 years ago. There was no difference between, I mean, the piece of wood can last 1,000 years if you take care of it. These materials are produced under pressure and under high temperature, and they naturally will relax over time. We just don't know what that time frame really is. I'll take any dilapidated old home with kids running all over it, perhaps overcrowded in an inner city, and perhaps with absentee landlords any day over a 3,000 square foot McMansion. I can make that inner city home last. I can't make the 3,000 square foot McMansion last beyond the year 2060. So I think we have to do everything we can to forestall demolition of these homes, to say that these are some of the most important resources that we have, to treasure them, to work with them, and then to have people like you who seem to care enough about them to inquire what can we do to make them work better. And I think the first thing we have to do is to stop tearing them down. Mm-hmm. From there on in, there's a lot of guidance one way or another.
Well, there's the scariest part of that, Bill, is we are building a lot of these McMansions, whole neighborhoods full of them. And mm-hmm. to suggest that they won't last, as I have no reason to doubt what you're saying, beyond the next 50, 60 years, is to say, well, they're just going to have to be everything's going to have to be torn down and rebuilt again. So we're not building things. Obviously, we're not making them like we used to.
We've crossed a threshold, in my opinion. We don't have facts and figures on this, of course, but we've crossed a threshold. It used to be that you say that an architect or a builder would say, I'm building that so that it stands the test of time. In other words, if we design it right and we build it right, then if it's maintained right, it can last as long as the owners or users of the building care to make it last. Mm-hmm. That's true with concrete. It's true with solid wood. These materials can last forever, essentially forever, if necessary. Mm-hmm. Forces other than natural dilapidation will determine the trajectory, the history mm-hmm. of this mm-hmm. particular thing. That's not so with products that have this ticking time bomb. Mm-hmm. I say 50 years. I know they'll last for 5. And I know they'll last for 15. I know they won't last for 500. Mm-hmm. But nobody knows about what the what this softening point is and what we should call the softening point in between. And what's really unfortunate here is that we're using these products precisely because of the scarcity of other products. Mm-hmm. We have to make the best of this. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything that we can or should be going to if we're looking in light frame construction. We might think more of masonry, but we're using trash trees now, and they're not easy to use.
Another example of this is some of the commercial buildings that are going up. I was reading an article about Walmart the other day, and I don't want to. My intention here isn't to go on a Walmart bashing tirade, but one of the things that this article stated is that most of these buildings, these super centers, are huge, 200,000 square feet, 500,000 square feet, however large they are. Maybe I'm exaggerating. I forget exactly how many thousands. But their lifespan is intended to be only about 20 years.
19. I've worked with McDonald's Corporation, uh-huh. Uh-huh. And 19 is what they're after. I think their accountants have picked that, but they consider that any building material that would last longer than 19 is value that's being stolen from the investors in the company, and they're not very happy about it. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting. Well, we have another call to talk with. Let's go to them. Someone in Champaign County on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, I'm late to the discussion, but you may have covered this point already, but I'm curious, of your opinion on local city councils, particularly I'm thinking of Urbana at the moment, who really don't encourage or, help homeowners to maybe, give them the idea to preserve, restore their houses, and not let them fall by the wayside, because eventually they're all torn down and you get just a crummy aluminum-sided building put up. So I guess I'm thinking from the political end or the city council end, if you have any observations on that. Thanks.
Well, I do. Any city government is subject to countervailing forces. For instance, in the state street named areas of Urbana, there's a strong push for development of student, particularly student housing, and there's also a push for preservation. Urbana is one of the few cities in Illinois that has a historic preservation ordinance. This forms historic districts that will have overview over how property can or cannot be demolished, or how it will be changed over time. And the second historic district for Urbana is going to a vote to the city council in, I think, just a matter of a week or two. But that's not to there are the makings for preservation within Urbana, as there are in other cities. So does Champaign, also has a historic preservation ordinance and commission. But you got to duke it out, and maybe we'll have to kind of, I don't know how far we can discuss this.
Well, we're just about out of time, unfortunately. But certainly might be worth mentioning that, citizens, residents, homeowners have a role in that process as well.
Absolutely. Main Street, yeah, in Urbana, mm-hmm, went up for vote in the as a historic district, and it didn't fly. And the reason it didn't fly was that there had to be a 25% buy-in by the neighborhood in order to really put it on the docket. And in the eyes of the Historic Preservation Commission of Urbana, that 25% was almost there, but not quite, and it really didn't go forward. A few more voices might have changed that.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. There's a topic that we could continue on for a long time, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we have an abbreviated version of this hour of Talk to the Architect. Our guest has been Bill Rose, research architect with the University of Illinois Building Research Council. And Bill, we certainly would love to have you back again.
Love to.
All right. Thanks so much.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. When we return in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking with author Joel Achenbach about his book, The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West. First, we'll take a break for some news and a market update.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety.